This is the 15th Naman interview, recorded on 29 September 13. In these interviews, we speak with personalities in the domain of human-computer interaction and related disciplines, having ideas that deserve a closer look. We spoke with John Takara of Doors of Perception. Doors is an event production company that organizes festivals in which grassroots innovators work with designers to imagine sustainable futures and take practical steps to realize them. John is a writer, advisor, and event producer. For 3 decades, he has traveled the world looking for live examples of what a sustainable future can be like. He writes about these stories online and in books. He uses them in talks and workshops for cities, universities, and businesses. What follows are some of his thoughts on big data and whether it can be utilized as a substitute for understanding and imagination.
There's a big question for me about whether information which exists digitally is the sum total of all information which is important. I think many other things are certainly more important in the way that human beings conduct their lives, which is to say that the different ways that we relate to each other and that we develop trust with each other are the result of breathing the same air, inhabiting bodies, being in situated locations, each of which is unique, and so on, all of which are analog forms of knowledge and information that in general are not captured by or even looked at by the digital devices of recording, you know, metadata about our phone calls or our credit cards or whatever. So I think the danger is you'll have a split between a world of radically amplified attention to digital information will squeeze out that information which is part of parcel of being a human being on the planet, not just in the sense of paying attention to the wrong place, but the way that we operate as a society, as groups, is by trusting each other to do things rather than relying on devices or laws or formal measures to do all this stuff. If all superhuman activity had to be regulated by laws and procedures and very, very abstract kind of rules, we wouldn't get much done. And I think that's the kind of danger we're facing. I'm rather sure that many people share this belief that you can reduce human experience and motivation and emotions and all of that, and of which trust is an aggregate of where we do things together, to numbers. I just don't think it works like that. And more extremely, I think we're moving from an economy in which the kind of search for transactions is the kind of what dominates business activity, to one in which notions of sharing resources, sharing time, sharing knowledge, sharing space is the very widespread response to how we're going to deal with the various crises that we've got to deal with. And that, I don't think, is something that can be reduced to algorithmic determinations of behavior and expectation. I think that trust is embodied, it's in groups, it's in social situations, it's in places, and that that's why it's so important that we understand the non-digital nature of trust in order to prospect for the way ahead. There is a different interpretations about human behavior through history, but there's a general consensus amongst anthropologists and ethnographers and economic historians that the notion of the gift has been the dominating form of human interaction for 95 to 98% of human history, and the notion of private interest, individual transactions and money has been the other 3 to 5% of the whole of history. So that when you hear now people talking about the sharing economy as one way forward to sustainability, that is new for young people. It's not new for people who were around at the beginning of the century when there was a huge amount of attention paid to the gift economy that we lost with the first phases of industrial economy and industrial civilization. So there's this kind of pendulum between sharing and individuality that operates throughout history, and I think we're very obviously coming back into a more shared collective form of culture now, with consequences for the economy, which is not well served by an attention to data which looks particularly at individuals rather than groups. There is an absolutely terrifying expectation on the part of the data fanatics that they can anticipate risks and change because with more information than they have now, which is not borne out by the history of accidents and strange events in history, which is that we know for a fact that systems can change radically according to as a consequence of things that we never have properly understood. You cannot map and therefore control things completely at all. There's a real danger in this collecting of ever larger amounts of information that we think it must be important because there is so much of it. But one of the most scary things to me, which everybody from climate scientists to epidemiologists to software engineers all talk about phase shifts or sudden transformations in the behavior of a system in consequence of things they don't actually know what the causes were. The Germans have a word which is very long to describe the prevalence throughout history and throughout all forms of knowledge of unexpected changes. And this is not something which is easily dealt with in the big data world, because data is about collecting lots of information and looking for patterns. But the whole point about phase shifts in systems is that they're a break in the pattern. So there is a kind of absolute problem of, for example, the security industry thinking that if they have enough information about, for example, who's telephoning who, this gives them some sense of safety, which I think will be a false one. I think the big data work well when it's important and useful to see what works and what doesn't in the world. So medicine is a good example of that. So there are several websites now. Cure Together is one, or ePatient Dave and others, where people who are sick with possibly strange or rare afflictions can share their experiences in a large group around the world of people who are uniquely motivated to find out what works and what does not work. And those sorts of collection and aggregation of information are very powerful, because very often it's been demonstrated already in just the last few years that when you get a few hundred people trying out different remedies or just therapies, unexpected things happen, that they discover that things work that nobody would have expected. Another example of, you know, it's not about large data gives you expected results. It's not always true. Even there, the problem is, or the danger is, that it focuses attention on health as a search for cures and actions, whereas the actual nature of the health world is that most of the care that is carried out for people with sicknesses or afflictions takes place outside the biomedical system. So what happens with doctors or with somebody taking drugs is 5% of the total. But if you have something like, I don't know, diabetes, then 90% of your life is spent away from doctors, away from hospitals, away from medication, leading a life in which you look after yourself and your friends and family help you deal with your situation as best they can, which is the undocumented, informal, non-monetized aspect of being healthy or living with a illness that is not measured by the normal measurements of transactions and therapies. So if we live in a world in which the resources available, for example, for medicine and healthcare are going to be at the very, very least frozen, if not contracting, then it makes more sense to me to look at the places where the greatest change can be achieved in care outcomes, namely the 95% of the time that we're looking after each other, rather than that tiny little slice of the picture, which is, you know, doctors doing things to us. This is not an easy story to sell, however, because, for example, if somebody is at home looking after a sick relative with dementia, that time is not recorded as an economic sort of activity in the national balance sheet. It's not monetized. You can't tax it. Companies can't, you know, augment it with services. So if, for example, with dementia, the average carer spends 80 hours a week being a carer, unpaid and unrecognized, that doesn't appear at all as an economic activity. But if you're the person with dementia or that carer, it's the dominating reality of your life. It's one of the many weird sort of misfits between what we choose to describe the economy as and how we spend our lives. And so, for example, just in terms of how to make things better or different, if somebody is doing 80 hours a week of care for somebody with dementia and they're given 2 or 3 hours off by a volunteer coming in for the morning to give them a chance to go out and just have a change of scene, that carer will be enabled to carry on for months, if not years, just by a hug, if 2 or 3 hours of volunteer time, which also doesn't figure as an economic transaction. Nobody's paid, nobody's taxed, nobody's regulated, nobody's monitored. But that's how people, you know, all over the world look after each other. And that's where outcomes, i.e., does that person with dementia have a good or bad life, is determined. I think that for large organizations, it's tough because one of the attractions to them of data is that they tend to sit in floods of data, and therefore they say, well, good, data is valuable because we have a lot of it. This is not a logical thought process. If you're a large organization, the sensible question is, in a world in which the very, very strong cultural shift is towards sharing things and towards being more efficient in the way that we use resources, whether it be time or soil or water, how can we, as a large organization, enable that sharing to happen more, better, more effectively, and to create more social and ecological value? That is, of course, a difficult question if you're not in that space at the moment, but that's, I think, the way that the sensible organization approaches innovation, is not to say, what can we do and how can we sell our skills, but what does the world need, or what do we think the world needs by way of support and infrastructure that we can use our skill set and our resources to provide. So, for example, with, I don't know, water is a good example. So it is known that gigantic amounts of energy and water itself are wasted by old and crumbling infrastructures that were, in good faith and with the latest knowledge, constructed over the last 150 years to a kind of industrial era logic. The cities of the world have to transform the way that they capture water, how households use it, what we use to clean things, all that. It's known, but it's very difficult to get millions upon millions of households to change their behavior, let alone to start doing things with hardware, such as barrels to capture rain in, that don't exist at the moment. So one can either, so if you're a big utility, for example, you can do one of two things. You can defend the old system and say, well, actually, gigantic amount of investment has been made in centralized water cleaning systems. Why change something which works? That is a coherent but short-term view. Or, as the more enlightened utilities are doing, say, okay, what can we do with our knowledge of water to help millions upon millions of households transform the water infrastructure of their city? And that is going to be a combination of scientific knowledge about water, together with the engineering knowledge about devices to capture it, and the social knowledge of how to help citizens be part of that process. It's totally different from building a dam, but the point is that's what the future demands, and the clever companies will embrace the complicated solution.